So welcome, everyone. It's wonderful to be here during Chol HaMoed Sukkot, during the intermediate days of the Festival of Sukkot, Festival of Tabernacles. And we have this class, Dancing Past the Graveyard. So you may have been wondering, what's the connection to Sukkot? So let's, at the outset, throw a question out that we're going to come back to a little later on. So please hold this in your periphery of your mind. Here's the question. Sukkot has a nickname. It's called the festival, the season of our joy. Each of the three holidays that we call pilgrimage holidays, because when there was a temple in Jerusalem, the pilgrims would go up. They'd be Ole L'Regel. They would go up to Jerusalem to be part of the festivities on Passover, on Pesach, on Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, where we commemorate the giving of the Torah. And then at the end of the year, after Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they go up for, right now, for Sukkot, to get rained on, of course. So they will go up to Jerusalem for Sukkot to partake of the Feast of the Tabernacles. So each of these is called something special. Passover is the season of our freedom, Zman Cherusenu. Shavuot is Zman Torah Senu, the season of our Torah, the giving of the Torah. And then Sukkot, where we are right now, is called the festival and the season Simcha Senu, of our joy, our simcha. It's beautiful. Sounds great. Joy. And yet, there is a book, very difficult book, that we read on the Sabbath of Sukkot. And it's called the Book of Ecclesiastes. In Hebrew, I like the name much better. It's called Koheles. Now, Ecclesiastes, I do not know, by the way, the evil person who gave this beautiful book this horrible name. You know, you've probably heard, like, it's ecclesiastical. Well, good luck on a Scrabble with that one. So why Ecclesiastes? Where does it come from? But the book is kind of a downer. Now, you know from a famous song from the late 60s, some of the lyrics. Remember, there's La Kol Zman Va'es, there's a time and a season and a time for everything under the sun, a time for joy, a time for sadness, a time for birth, a time for death, correct? So that is, by the way, the most hopeful and most optimistic sentence in the entire book. Everything else is written by King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech. Everything else is sort of a downer, to say the least. He uses the word hevel. It's just like meaningless. And Solomon is basically saying the following, right? He's saying, look, I'm the king of the world. And he was, Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest man, King Solomon. And I have all the riches of the world. And he did, even though he didn't abuse that privilege. And he's saying to you, if you think that money and fame are the source of happiness, think again. Sorry, it's hevel havolim. It's just meaningless. It's not real. And he sort of, it's tough, you know, like, for example, you may have been at a funeral and you've heard the rabbis say that tov, shame, that a person's good name is better than the finest oil. And it says the day of death is better than the day of birth somehow. So it's like very mystical, a lot of, now you might say, well, what does this have to do with Sukkot? Because you see, each holiday has a Megillah, has a book that we read, right? So for example, the most famous Megillah is on Purim, the book of Esther, Megillat Esther. And then we have the book of Ruth, which is read on Shavuot. Each of the holidays has a book that we read, that we're sort of connecting to the essence of what that holiday is about. So why would Sukkot, this time of our festive seasoning, have this downer of a book called Ecclesiastes, Koheles, which sort of deals with the futility of the pursuit of worldly things and joy in this world? Like, it sounds strange. It almost sounds like there is something contradictory. It's an oxymoron. Seems to contradict the nature of our joy, maybe. We'll come back to that. So here is the question, then, that we're going to try to answer today. How do we reconcile? The name of the festival is Joy Time. Have a great time. Enjoy. And we do, believe me. Right? You have a little l'chaims and the sukkah. And as long as it's not raining on you, it's not bad. Right? As long as the wasps and the hornets and the mosquitoes and everybody else leaves you alone, it's not bad. Right? It's not a horrible time. But to call it the time of our joy, and then to say, oh, by the way, you got to read this book. So, you know, there are rabbis out there, I am not one of them, who has a great answer. Ready? Well, the reason that you read this book, which is a downer book, the Book of Ecclesiastes, is God doesn't want you to be too happy. So he wants to modulate and limit your joy. Now that's, I hate to say this, because please, if some rabbi you know of said this, I'm not making fun of them, but that's ridiculous. God doesn't want to limit someone's joy. It must be then that this book called Kohelet, this book called Ecclesiastes, must have something fundamental. It must define the essence of what Sukkot is about. And that's what we're going to explore today. Dancing past the graveyard. So in order to answer this question, I've got to take you back on a little journey, okay? And the journey starts in order from when the Jewish people leave Egypt. So let's go back a little. I'm going to take you on a little journey right now. It won't take long, I promise. You won't even have to leave your seats. Although I am on airplane mode here with my recorder, so one never knows. You know the joke, right? When you travel on the airplane, they force you. You know, they always come by. Otherwise, you get in big trouble. They may exit stage left. You don't want to mess with the flight attendants post-COVID, right? You may wind up in shackles or worse. You never know. So we always obey. So here is the journey. The Jewish people are in Egypt. We get out of Egypt on Passover. And then we journey through the desert and we live in huts called Sukkot. So Sukkot's already kind of around. And then 49 days later, the 50th day, we celebrate Sinai. The Torah, the Ten Commandments are given. So you have the first two major Jewish holidays. And then Moses goes up for 40 days and 40 nights to get the commandments, the Ten Commandments, on a tablet form. And then we know that all bad stuff broke loose down below. The Jewish people believed Moses was dead. He wasn't coming back. By the way, is it a little warm in here or is it my imagination?
A little warm.
Okay, just making sure that I'm okay. You know, you always wonder, is it me or is it the reality? So now I know it's reality. Good. So what happens during the time that Moses is up the mountain? The rabble gather around Aaron. And Aaron is the high priest who's been left in charge. And they kill Aaron's nephew, also Moses' nephew, son of Miriam. They murder him. And they say, we want something to replace Moses. We believe Moses is dead. And they construct the infamous golden calf, the Egel HaZahav. And that golden calf destroys everything. It almost destroys the Jewish people at that time. Moses has to pray and pray and pray more for God to... And God even says, look, we're going to go ahead, yes. But when I take an accounting of the Jewish people in the future, just know that when there's a punishment brought upon the Jews forever and ever, part of that punishment will be for this moment right now, when we're at literally the base of Sinai and you build a calf. So they build the calf, things don't go well, and then what does Moses do? He goes up twice more, he gets atonement for the Jewish people after shattering the tablets and everything down below and judging and putting to death those participants in building the calf. And ultimately, what happens with Moses? He comes down the mountain, and God has said to Moses, give the news to the Jewish people. Salachti kidvarecha. I have forgiven you, just as you requested. Guess what day that was? Well, we just had it a few days ago. Yom Kippur. That was the very first day of atonement. So you see that the entire journey from Egypt, the Exodus, to the desert, and you have the huts in the desert protecting the Jews, Sukkot. And then you have Sinai. And then it brings you through that sort of summer period, and it culminates with the Day of Atonement, where God says, you have been forgiven for the sin of the golden calf. And then right from that moment, we are just jettisoned 4 days later into this holiday called Sukkot. So clearly there is linkage between all these events. So I hope that I've now sort of mapped out visually for you in your mind sort of the sequence and how the calendar makes sense and how historically it all kind of, the pieces fit together, right? Hasn't answered our question. Yeah, the question we're trying to answer, well, where does the joy come from? And why are you calling this class Dancing Past the Graveyard? Interesting. Well, we're going to come back to that, but just hold off for a moment. So let's discuss Sukkot a little bit itself, okay? Today, what I'm going to describe, it does not apply. But in an agricultural Israel of yesteryear, what I'm going to tell you applies. It doesn't cost a lot to build a sukkah. Now, today we have all the prefab sukkahs. You can go online, and I am really not exaggerating. You can ask Bruce right over here because he was looking for, you know, different sukkah options. You can get like modular sukkahs, you know, made out of like space age metals for a couple thousand bucks that will just hook together without any knowledge of, you know, metallurgy or metalworking and stuff. You can put it up like in an hour with beautiful pre-decorated prefab. I'm not going to shock you by saying that wasn't what used to apply 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, in an agricultural society, the rabbis even said, they used words, psolet gorin ve'yakev. They would take the discarded elements of the crops. You know, so you'd have some leftover sheaves of this type of wheat or the corn or whatever grew, and they would cut it down and they would just boom, boom, boom. Without any minimum of fuss, they put up a sukkah. And everybody's sukkah was a little different depending on what type of crops you grew. It was a very easy endeavor, not like today where we take it, you know, we've kind of taken things a little too seriously, I think. You know, especially, you know, during the, I don't know if you've ever, anyone ever see the great movie? It's a great movie called Ushpizen. It's a great movie. It's about, it takes place in Israel, and it's about this diamond etrog that was for sale for like $2,000. You know, the citron, the etrog fruit, and this very poor Jew kind of wins. He gets charity, and instead of like spending on his family to take care of food, he and his wife, who are barren, end up buying this diamond etrog. It doesn't end well for the lemon, for the citron. But people, and I'm not exaggerating, take things very seriously. If you go looking for like your own etrog in Jerusalem or in parts of New York, you know what the little jeweler's glasses are? The ones that are like mini electron microscopes? You will see people with them on, you know, looking at the etrog for blemishes, you know? And I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, if God ever looked at us that way, we're God, right? Like, make sure that God is wearing, you know, ill-fitting glasses when he's magnifying my sins of the year past. I don't want to be put under the scrutiny of that poor etrog for fear of a blemish, because you'll find a lot, right? So anyway, suffice it to say, we take it very seriously. But in the agricultural Israel, it was an easy win, right? You just put together some stuff from the crops. You had your sukkah. You leave your house for 7 days, not 8 days or longer, because in Israel, it's just the first day and seventh day are holy. There's a seven-day festival. It's wonderful. It's easy. So what's interesting, though, you ready for this? I'm recording it, so I can't be misquoted. But in a very real way, the non-Jewish people have a holiday very similar to this holiday. It's called Halloween. If you look historically, this is not made up. You'll Google this after. You will see that the origins of having like a harvest festival at the in-gathering, that's what Halloween it is, right? And what is Halloween all about? Everyone's dressed up celebrating what? Death. Because it's understood that in an agricultural society, this time of year, things are dead or in their last throes of dying. Because that's what happens. It's called the festival of the ingathering. So yes, I understand there's all the trick-or-treat and all the other nonsense that they do on Halloween. But in its essence, the idea of the skeletons and the graveyards, I see graveyards all around my streets now, you know, people put up graves, and I'm like, wow. So it makes dancing past the graveyard very real. It's easy. My neighbors put up fake graves. I'm thinking, wow, okay. But Halloween at its essence, historically, like the source, if you will, comes from the same idea, that this is a time of ingathering. Do you know what the name of Sukkot is other than the Festival of Tabernacles Sukkot? And the time of our season, guess what it's called? Chag Ha'asif. Chag, the festival. You know what Asif means? To be ingathered. You know what it means to be ingathered in the Torah? It means they're taking you out to be buried. How do I know this? Well, when Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and even Ishmael in the book of Genesis die, it says by each of them, Vayeasef el Amav. He was gathered unto his people. So when you are gathered unto your people, it's a beautiful, very poetic way of the Torah saying you passed away. It doesn't use the word death by the patriarchs. It says they were gathered, to be gathered amongst the people. So when we're celebrating a festival called the Festival of Asif, to be gathered, that has a very stark connotation of death. And it's in keeping with what's going on around us in the world, right? Because when should Sukkot, historically, chronologically, be celebrated? It should be celebrated right after Passover. Because ostensibly, when they leave Egypt, They go across the river. We know Yul Brynner, unfortunately, did not make it across the river. Sorry, I'm making a shout out to the Ten Commandments movie, right? Yeah. Yul Brynner and the boys did not make it across, but Charlton Heston did. So Chuck Hatt, did Edward G. Robinson make it across? I in real life he did. I don't know in the movie. Where's your God now, Moses, right? I'm not sure if he did in the movie. Good casting, by the way. Yes, good casting. So I think Edward G. Robinson and Chuck Heston did make it across. And at that point, what were they living in? You know, there wasn't, as far as I know, there wasn't like a Motel 6 out there, the Sinai Motel 6, you know, waiting for you. They constructed little huts, Sukkot. So we were already living in a sukkah. So chronologically, when should Sukkot fall? Between Passover and Shavuot, before we get to Sinai. Chronologically, right? Oh, but we don't do it. Why? Because we want to be miserable and put it in a time when the rains are falling. Why? Because we want to show that we're not going to leave our homes to go to a sukkah. Because it's a beautiful weather in the month of May and June, which it would be. In other words, if you left your homes and went out to your little sukkah, and your neighbors who are not Jewish looked over and said, hey, how come the Jews are going out now? And they would see, we'd explain, well, we're going out to honor God. They'd say, oh, they'd be a little facetious, right? They'd say, oh, well, gee, you picked 72-degree weather. It's beautiful, of course. Hey, maybe I'll join you, right? But when you go out in October and the rains are coming down because Olaf Tzedek has a sukkah barbecue, right? And or you're living in, like, parts of Canada and you're going out there, you know, 33 degrees in your sukkah at night to make kiddush, they might think you're a little off, right? But that's the whole point, is that we're showing the world our commitment to God. And if we chose a seasonal time that was beautiful and warm, it wouldn't show that same commitment and fidelity to God. So specifically, the rabbi said, no. We're not going to celebrate it chronologically after Passover. We're going to push it back to the end of the year. But that's not the only reason. Clearly, as I pointed out, the flow of events, somehow there's this interrelationship between Yom Kippur, and then the night of Yom Kippur, after you had your bagels, lox, and cream cheese. By the way, do you ever notice how Yom Kippur is a delightful day when you're 1 hour past it and had your bagels, lox, and cream cheese? Just an observation from years of fasting. Okay, but what are you supposed to do? It actually says this in the halacha. I never do this, I have to confess. Never once have I done this, but there must be pious Jews somewhere who do this. Guess what they do? Well, how they occupy themselves 1 hour after Yom Kippur. Putting up their sukkah. It says that's when you start building your sukkah. Wow. So clearly, the rabbis see this relationship between Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, going right in, like a segue, if you will, into Sukkot. So it's done specifically because of the rainy season to show our love and fidelity to God. Yes, that's true. But also, there's this correlation that we haven't yet answered between Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and Sukkot, okay? So then where are we holding? Let's just back up now and sort of see where we are. So we understand now the chronology of events that led us from Passover, the Exodus, to the time of Yom Kippur, where we were forgiven on Yom Kippur for our sins. That we understand now. But the open questions are, number one, we said, why, if it's the time of our simcha, of our joy, why diminish that joy by sort of foisting a book called Ecclesiastes upon us that is a downer of a book? And it can't just be because we don't want you to be too happy, Rabbi. No, it must be that an integral part of Sukkot and joy is death. Like, how does that work? How do you dance past the graveyard? And by the way, I just want to thank Keith mentioned that in New Orleans, right? You saw this yourself, Keith. Thank you. That they actually do dance past the graveyard. When they have a funeral, it's like a celebration. Keith had said he's seen this. And they do a lot of dancing. And so, again, it's very interesting. So thank you for sharing that, Keith. But that's a separate component. But it is interesting. Different, you know, cultures have different ways of burying and honoring the dead. But we still have to reconcile dancing with somehow with death, with the graveyard. What could that mean for us? Okay. So what I want to share right now is, what's the feeling of a sukkah? How can a sukkah represent joy? I mean, it's usually the weather's lousy. So how is it joyous? So I believe that sukkah represents freedom from the physical. And it's liberating to leave behind all your toys and to sit outside in a sukkah, stripped and bereft of all the little niceties that we have in our homes. And we sit there in this little sukkah, and we have our kiddush, and we have hamotzah, we have our challah bread, and we have some delicious chicken soup because it's cold, of course. And sometimes we just look at each other and say, you know what, my gosh, wow. After all we've been through on Yom Kippur and getting to this point of Rosh Hashanah, all that holiday, and now I just get to be with my loved ones, my friends, my family, and I get to sit in a little hut, you know? It's kind of liberating. It feels really, I'm sort of at one with nature, and I'm at one with God. So maybe there isn't a conflict there. In other words, Sukkot is the ability to leave behind the search, the quest for the money tree. I think Styx had a whole album. Doc, I know you're a big into like a lot of things. They had a search for the money, for the possessions that sort of inhibit our ability just to enjoy life. I mean, I know as a rabbi, I have to tell you honestly, I love when I get to put my iPhone to bed for Shabbat, for the Sabbath or Yom Tov. It's liberal. Like, I'm tied to this because that's just my job. I get texts, I did, right? But it's so liberating to know that, hey, if somebody wants me, they can actually come to my home the old-fashioned way and knock on the door. Hey, is the rabbi up? Can we talk, right? It's like the old days. I don't need to be constantly, you know, attached to an electrical device and be subservient. So maybe Sukkot, in its own unique way, it strips away the veneer that clouds our ability to have a relationship with our family and, of course, with our Creator. And that's what Sukkot's all about. But let's back up. How does that come into the mix? Okay, let's go back to the golden calf, shall we? What happened at the golden calf? So there were certain people who wanted to replace Moses because Moses was the connection, the physical connection to God. So the calf somehow, which was like a baby cow, represented eternal youth. It represented the exuberance of life for these people. Others saw it as outright idolatry. And there was a mixture. The people, by the way, who promoted the calf were not really the Jewish people. The Jewish people kind of sadly sat on the sidelines, kind of just allowed it to evolve. They didn't mish around. When Moses came down and said, hey, we got to take things under control now, then the Jewish people came in. But there were a mixed multitude of people who were Egyptian slaves along with the Jewish slaves. And we call them the Erevrav, the mixed rabble, the riffraff. I like that term, the riffraff. My sixth graders, when I used to teach them, they loved that term, the riffraff. So the riffraff, they were the ones who instigated and killed Hur, who was the nephew of Aaron and Moses, and did all these crimes. And they built that calf. Now, we allowed it to happen, so we're guilty, of course. That doesn't exonerate the Jews. But what happens? Some of the people were bowing and praying. Some were giving it gifts. And you know what a lot of them were doing?
Dancing.
And it's not a little thing. Why? Because up on Mount Sinai, on the summit of Mount Sinai, Moses gets the horrible news. God says, I know you've been 40 days and 40 nights up here with the angels and me. You got to go down because your people have tragically disgraced and corrupted themselves. They built a golden calf. Moses is shell-shocked. He doesn't say a word. God says, you know, please don't pray. Stop praying. Let me annihilate them, and we'll start again with you, Moses. Moses thinks to himself, wait a minute, I haven't even begun to say word one. Why are you telling me to be quiet and not pray? Oh, must be God's hinting, prayer would be a good thing, Moses. Okay. And then Moses starts to pray, and he basically says, God, they're 7 weeks removed from Egypt. There were idols galore in Egypt, right? The original Idols R Us superstores began in Egypt. In Cairo and Alexandria. So everybody was into idol worship. And at the sea, the Egyptians had adorned their chariots with gold and jewelry in honor of wiping out the Jews. And so when they got crushed under the waves, all that gold and stuff wound up on the shores and the Jews collected it. Okay, so you give this infant nation a bunch of gold. They don't know what to do with it. They still have this deep, dark desire to worship idols, and you throw them the gold and you give them the opportunity. Are you surprised that they did this? That's sort of the attitude, according to the Midrash, the oral tradition, of how the defense of Moses went for the Jews. Okay, then he comes down the mountain, and Joshua and he return to the camp. And they hear the crying and the wailing and the singing, and they see the people. And what does it say? When Moses sees the calf, the golden calf, and the people dancing around the calf, he just blows a gasket, takes the Ten Commandments, and he shatters the tablets. Well, wait a minute. Moses, up on Mount Sinai, you were a little laissez-faire about the whole thing. How come right now you're acting so viscerally? Like, what happened? There's only one word of new information that the Torah tells us. Dances. God didn't say anything to Moses up at the summit that they were dancing, but down below they were dancing. So what is a dance? So think about it for a moment. Moses is thinking, wait a minute, it's bad enough that you created a golden calf. You imagine this idol that is non-existent. Not real. It's fake. But you project the human mind into a golden calf and you pray to it, okay, we can accept that. You accept it as a god, maybe a replacement for me. All right, fine. But when you start doing the hora, the dance around it, and you're pointing to the calf and saying, this is really God, somehow the dance brings a reality of what this means to a level that there's no return. And the only way to bring them back from the precipice of destruction was to bring them back to reality by shattering the Ten Commandments. And that's what he did. He literally just broke it on their heads to sort of wake them up from their reverie. Guys, come on, what's going on? All right. This is beautiful. You ready for this? What point in the year did a mandate occur where Jewish people are supposed to dance? There's three times that we dance. Two of them are going to be a little foreign for you. Well, right. Weddings and bar mitzvahs for sure, but I'm saying by Jewish holidays. You ready? You ready for this? This is really neat. And you're right. And that's why we dance. And it's exactly the same reason, as you'll see. Thank you, Al. Ready for this? Listen to this. There's a little holiday in the summer called Tu B'Av, the 15th day of Av. It happens right after the 9th of Av. And it's said that the young unmarried girls of Jerusalem would go out into the vineyards, and all the unmarried Jewish guys would kind of get their chairs and sit and have like a little audience. By the way, when you did this, there was no singles crisis, I promise you. And all the young maidens would put on their finest dresses, and they would dance for the boys. And they would say, hey, young man, lift up your eyes. Do you want beauty? Do you want genetics? Whatever you're after, come on, let's choose life. And that happened not once, but twice. You ready? Happened on this little holiday called Tu B'Av in the summer after the 9th of Av, just 6 days later. And then it happened, you ready for this one? Yom Kippur afternoon. Now, we don't do this anymore, but just picture, okay? The rabbi of a 5,000-person synagogue, you know, it's a very serious day. Musaf just ended. You just went through the whole ordeal of the 10 martyrs, and it's very heartrending, and right? It's like that, you get that hour, 2 hour, if you're lucky, maybe 2.5 hour break before you have to come back from Mincha at the end of Yom Kippur. And then the rabbi goes up and he pounds the lectern, hits the shtender. He goes, okay, all unmarried guys and girls, it's Yom Kippur, yes. Go out into the fields and dance, girls, for the guys. And they would do it on Yom Kippur. They would dance again on Yom Kippur. And what's the third time? Simchas Torah, which is the end of the entire process. At the end of Sukkot, you have this little add-on holiday, which in Israel is 1 day. Here it's 2 days. And it's called Simchat Torah. And what do we do on Simchat Torah? It's the only time of the year we do it. We dance with the Torahs, and hopefully we don't drop them. We dance with the Torahs, and we drink a little bit, and it's fun. It is letting your hair down in a major way. Simchat Torah. So you have these three holidays, two of which the young girls are supposed to dance, showing the exuberance of life. And then you have this holiday called Simchas Torah, which is at the end of Sukkot, the festival of Simcha, of joy, where we dance. Interesting. So there was a great singer, and I call him a poet for our generation. His name is Jackson Browne. He's still alive. He's about 70-ish. He used to write songs with the Eagles. He wrote Take It Easy and a couple of other famous songs that made the Eagles famous. And he's a very well-known, like, singer. You may probably have heard of him. He actually had a song called The Dance. And The Dance expresses this exuberance for life and for the joy of life and what it means to have life. And that's what Sukkot is all about. In other words, if you strip away all those things that get in the way of who we are and what I am and what my purpose is in this world and what my relationship is with God, what my relationship is with my family and my loved ones, if you strip all the garbage away, that's what Sukkot does. It brings us intimately in touch with the things that actually are a priority or should be a priority. And I'll sit in my little sukkah and I'll say, you know what? Solomon was right. Because what did Solomon say in the book of Ecclesiastes that I have to answer the question? Remember what he said? Everything's vanity. You know what he was saying? Wow. He says, look, guys, if you think the hunt for material gain is going to make you happy, you're an idiot. I'm the richest man who ever lived. I'm King Solomon. And I promise you, he says, you'll never have more wives, more horses, or more money than me. Nobody, not even Bezos, Zuckerberg, or Musk. None of you have more money than me. And yet I promise you, for all the money I have, it's garbage. The only thing that matters is the dance of life. To strip away, that we do magically on Sukkot, all the things that get in the way, the materialism. That's why Sukkot has to be with sort of the discarded remnants of the crop. Not things that matter or have an objective value, but they have a subjective value. And that's what Sukkot is all about. Where it's the appreciation of the existence of life, the exuberance that we should experience being alive. After Yom Kippur, we come from the day where we recreate ourselves and we make up with our creator and our maker. And God is saying, okay, you want to really now be with me? Step outside of the home. Step outside of your materialism. Come join me for a little holiday called Sukkot. And you will be happier than you could ever imagine. And that's what Sukkot's all about. That's why it has to follow naturally. That after you reclaim your identity through repentance on Yom Kippur, what's the next step? Leave the home. Come celebrate with God, living life itself. And the dance that Jackson Brown refers to is both life, but it's also death. Because think about it for a moment. It's the fact that we live in an entropic universe. The fact that there is death in our world that makes life joyous and worth living. If we were all eternal beings, as wonderful as it sounds in your mind, I promise you, it's not. Because if you lived eternally, each moment would be insignificant. There would be no holiness or uniqueness. Some would say, wow, what a unique moment, Rabbi. I say, well, no. If we live another 3 billion years, I promise you this moment would come again and again and again. There's no uniqueness to this moment. So what makes each moment, each family connection, each parent and love them that we have in our lives, what makes it unique and special is that this moment that we're sharing right now, this class, will never happen again in the history of the world. It is unique on its own. And that is the celebration of Sukkot. So it makes entirely perfect sense that there is this graveyard sort of in the back of our mind. I have an appreciation. In other words, I'm celebrating Sukkot at a time when things are dying. Why? Because that entropy, that end, that finite gift of life makes me at Sukkot really take stock of the things in life that matter to me. So we should all merit this Sukkot to imagine the dance. And yes, we've lost people, a lot of people in our community, and we're no longer what we were. But you know what? We're here at the JCC learning Torah during Sukkot, and we have a fantastic audience today. I am thrilled. I hope you've shared that excitement. We're here, and we have a future, please God, and that this dance, this Sukkot, and this Simchas Torah, when we get up and celebrate with the Torahs, a new beginning, a new cycle, the opportunity is there for us. And we can grow, we can continue to prosper. And God willing, next year we're going to be bigger, better, and even stronger. I wish everyone a wonderful Yom Tov.